I don't think I know anyone who does not want to be free. But I know plenty of people who have not thought about what freedom really is. There is something unique about freedom. It is possible to attain great wealth while others suffer degrading poverty. We know that some people gain great knowledge while others remain illiterate and uneducated. But personal freedom is closely linked to the freedom of others. Many of those who have achieved great power have often done so at the expense of other people's sovereignty. But freedom is different. Whilst being the most valuable thing a person can possess, as all those who have ever lost it understand completely, it can only ever be yours whilst others share it. There are rich men in poor countries and educated men in backward ones. But while there are powerful people in tyrannical dictatorships, there are no truly free people in these countries, not even the tyrant himself. You see, freedom is a macro product. It only exists in free societies. We would like to be able to tell you that you can have yours and you don't have to worry about anybody else's. That would make it much simpler for you and me. But your freedom cannot be had unless I am allowed mine also. The nature of freedom itself demands that we work together on this thing called freedom potentials. If there is slavery in the house next to yours, in the country next to yours, or in the hemisphere next to yours, your own freedom is at risk, for the lust for power over others cannot rest until it consumes all. If any man on earth is a slave, then with time or circumstance, you may be next. So how can you be free? There is only one way. You must help make others free. If others are free, so will you be free as an indirect and inevitable result. Where does freedom begin? That is a simple question to which there is a very simple answer. Freedom begins with service. Freedom grows out of the voluntary involvement of individuals in the creation and maintenance of a free society. Voluntary service is the only road to freedom. The springs of freedom are not in compulsion, but in voluntary service motivated by love. I hope that's why you are involved in this course. The worst side of human nature would have us enslave those we might hate or despise and regard as our enemies. In doing this, we betray ourselves and our own freedom. You see, the luxury of hatred cannot be indulged without the bringing slavery more closely to yourself. The more freedom is given to others, the more it is retained for oneself. We can say then that freedom is a social objective. It is something we work towards in association with others. Freedom is destroyed to the extent that it is withheld from others. We have therefore chosen to begin with the best foundation for ideal relationships, and that is the concept and practice of service. Many years ago, a Christian catechism was written which asked the question, "In whose service is perfect freedom?" One possible answer to this question is the service of self. One of the great difficulties in serving self is that individuals usually have only a very limited concept of their own best interests. The criminal who assaults his fellow citizen for a few dollars is a classic case of a limited understanding of one's own best interest. In this case, the criminal's immediate self-interest is extended by a few dollars. However, in restricting the freedom of others in order to extend his lot, he has forced upon others the compulsion of defending themselves. Together, they are stronger than he is, and they impose forcible restrictions upon his freedom. A man who understands his highest or best self-interests understands that he best serves himself now if he does so in such a way that his own interests of 20 or 30 years' time are not betrayed either through destroying his own reputation or credibility, or by taking action which will cause the world of all his and his children's tomorrows to be a lesser place. Such a man can perhaps answer yes as to whether perfect freedom is attainable through serving himself. This is only so, however, because he already understands that his extended self-interest does include others in his community, others in his nation, and ultimately all men, even those of future generations. In whose service is perfect freedom? Perhaps it is in the service of others. Yes, certainly, but first, to thine own self be true. As Shakespeare told us, if you remain true to yourself, you shall betray no man. There is conflict between being loyal and true to oneself and serving others. Both promote truth, both promote your best interests and those of others. In the end, those who see the world in terms of conflict between self and others both believe in and fulfill a world of dog-eat-dog and self-disserve-self, in which all lose and are deceived of the truth of men's mutual common interests. Serving others is definitely not the same thing as doing good to others. In serving others, or doing good to them, there is a basic issue which must be addressed. It asks, who is the best arbiter of what is best for others? If you are, then of course you shall do good to them. But we are all familiar with the politicians, or the tyrants, who do good to the citizenry, whether they want it or not. We are also familiar with the old adage that the way to hell is paved with good intentions. But genuine service to others is on their terms, towards ends freely chosen by others. The warm inner glow of condescension toward others, which motivates the do-gooders to do his good to you, is the devil's parody of love. It's a trap for both he who falls victim to the do-gooder and to the do-gooder himself. English Christians are familiar with the prayer in which God is referred to as the one in whose service is perfect freedom. Through acting in accordance with total creation, we promote our highest social objective, which is freedom. If we are going to be free, we are going to be true to others, true to ourselves, and true to reality itself. You see, freedom is inextricably bound up with truth, but we may well ask, what is truth? It is beyond any human being to give a full or really extensive answer, except in the most symbolic forms. Pontius Pilate asked this question of Christ as he washed his hands. Perhaps Pilate's greatest legacy was in showing that no man can wash his hands clean of it. His hands, as it were, are still stained. How we relate to truth defines the very nature of our own beings. Truth and reality transcend human thinking. Irrespective of our concepts as to what is true or what is real, whether they be correct or incorrect, truth and reality stand inviolate. You can bear false witness or true witness to the truth, the results of which will possibly alter men's perception of the truth. Yet no man can violate truth itself in the sense that he can alter it. Truth comes to people through the filter of their own integrity. Ultimate integrity, while never achievable, allows us to accept ultimate truth. The truth never lies to us. We lie to ourselves. If we lie to ourselves convincingly enough, then we lose touch with reality, and that is the definition of madness. We all try to keep account of the times when our integrity was spotlessly maintained, which we cheerfully note on the credit side. On the other side, perhaps for fear that we will need to know what lies we have told so that we can tell the same lie consistently, we rather reluctantly make the debit entries. This account, which we all keep, is known as conscience. Therefore, if one is to serve the cause of freedom potentials, one must seek true freedom in line with a knowledge of the truth and with a clear conscience. The application of freedom, or the realization of freedom, is all important, and it can only be achieved in action. The achievement of a free society, the extension of freedom, is bound up with the service approach to life. This is not all that extraordinary, in that a great many people understand that if you really want something, the best way of achieving it is to give it to others. Let's take an example. A man would like to become rich. There are only two prospects of him doing so. One might be called the disservice approach, where he can acquire another man's wealth through some disservice like theft or fraud. The other approach to becoming rich is to determine upon making others rich. The vast, vast majority of people who have become rich have done so through enriching others. through offering them service at a cheaper price, through offering them a better product, through showing them how to produce a product more cheaply, in less time, or of greater quality. If you can go to another individual and say, "Sir, madam, I have an idea. I have a product. I have a service which will make you rich. They are interested. All you have to do is deliver." Those who can deliver become rich in doing so. If you want your family and friends to respect you, to love you, to help you, then the only sure road, indeed the only road, is to respect and love and help them. The service approach works. It is the strategy of the indirect approach. If you enrich others, you will become rich in doing so. If you love others, you will be loved in return. This is part of the automatic axiom in life that action and reaction are equal and opposite. Freedom is a word that is very often associated with responsibility. Sometimes the two words come together to describe responsible freedoms. This term is used to differentiate freedom from what is properly called license. Any individual or group who attains power for a time and exercises this power in order to undo or override the freedoms of others will usually claim that they are merely exercising their own freedom. This is not so. When freedom is claimed with which to destroy the freedom of others, what is actually demanded is license. Freedom and responsibility are so interrelated that the origins and existence of one is impossible without that of the other. The bane of the tyrant is that by withdrawing freedom from his people, he inevitably removes their responsibility also. The citizens leave the responsibility to others for such things as the care of assets, the efficiency of production, and all of the other essentials for a strong and vibrant society, and thus tyrannical communities ultimately find that through tyranny the strength of society withers. The bird can be captured, but in captivity it slowly dies. No matter how benevolent the person in authority is, the best judges of guilt or innocence are those who most closely understand the customs, the background, the circumstances, and the ethos in which a dispute took place. A man's peers who have shared the same circumstances through life were, in English history, considered to be the best judges. The English development of the jury system and of common law, which made such a great contribution to freedom, will be discussed in the coming segments. The English-speaking peoples have a great heritage which is based on a healthy respect for freedom. The English had two great advantages in their contribution towards the development of freedom in the world. One was the moat of the English Channel. It made them less fearful because they were relatively isolated from their neighbours and potential enemies. They did not suffer the frequent deprivations of invasion or counter-invasion that almost every continental generation had to endure. The other great advantage the English had was that they had almost universally adopted a common philosophy. As it happens, it was Christian. The founder of Christianity, Jesus Christ, was once asked which was the greatest of the commandments. He promulgated the law of love and said that on this law hung all the law and the prophets. When King Alfred established the beginnings of English law by proclaiming the Ten Commandments as the laws, they were at the time all of the laws of England. It was against this background that the law of love towered above all law. The outworkings of the law of love in a nation in which it was universally proclaimed, although, of course, given human nature, not universally upheld, eventually went so far as to establish a system of law, whereby one was assumed to be acting in accordance with the law and upholding the law, unless and until it could be demonstrated and proved to the contrary. The law of love was not one, obviously, of distrust, which said, "We will limit your freedom until you prove to us that you operate from a motive of love." Rather, the law of love was one of trust, where it was assumed that this law was respected and upheld by all, with all of the rights and freedoms which flowed from it inviolate. Freedom and discretion were the rule, unless someone operating from contrary motives in the judgment of his peers violated the freedom and integrity of others in the community. Where men genuinely acknowledge and apply the law of love to each other, they grow in confidence to trust each other. Where you can trust your neighbor and he you, restrictions can be lifted, and everyone can enjoy freedom so long as they respect it. The purpose of this segment has been to introduce a few basic considerations which will help in your preparation to see all the information and material from a greater and broader perspective. With this in mind, the overview, the proper context, the broader outline which will be enormously important to you in seeing and assessing the material which follows, cannot be sought from a hillock or from the foothills. It must be sought from a high moral viewpoint. Therefore, we have tried, in a very introductory way, to point you to the reality of truth, or in other words, God. You can call it either or both, but you cannot escape such a concept which embodies the absolutes. Essential unchangeable rules like the law of gravity in the physical area command our obedience no less than the law of love in human motivation. In the same way, service is the way to freedom in social relationships and organization. In discussing concepts of this importance, this power, and this grandeur, one must be a little adventurous, for we are addressing ourselves to the very spirit of freedom. While we are completely committed to a position of theological non-partisanship, we nevertheless owe it to those who undertake the course to make it plain that those who prepared and produced it do see themselves as practical Christians. We acknowledge that this has influenced us, and therefore we understand that not everybody will be able to fully endorse every aspect of what is presented in this school. Without claiming any unique insights into God's purpose for the last 2,000 years, we do think it legitimate to observe that something has happened in that period, and some things have been learned. One is that where the law of love is applied in society, patience, trust, and expanding freedom for all will follow in its wake. We don't believe we have the right to be surprised in this, because Jesus Christ, who promulgated the law of love, also told us that the truth would set us free. The law of love did set us free. The law of love is most assuredly truth. Ultimately, although great care must be taken to establish exactly what we are saying when we use the word freedom, and great effort must be made to relate it properly to responsibility, to society, to the nature of truth, and much else, it is also true that anything that does not set us free is not of the truth. Ours is not the difficult undertaking of creating truth. Our task is to discover it, to admit to it, to understand it, to obey it, and to apply it. In this way, we shall discover freedom. Welcome to Freedom Potentials.